From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello and welcome to another ARRL Doctor Is In podcast. I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, let's talk about HF propagation. I mean, that's something that you would think would be pretty straightforward for most people. You get on the air, you turn on your radio, and the bands are good or not so good or whatever to wherever you're trying to get. But it's really obviously much more complicated than that, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the good news is while it is complicated, you don't really have to know how it works to use it.
That's right.
It's like swimming. Why is the water holding me up? Well, I don't know, but as long as I'm not under the water, I'm okay.
Yes.
And the propagation is about the same way. It can learn about the physics of the ionosphere and how all that works, or you can turn your radio on, and as you say, if you hear somebody out there and can talk to them, there must be propagation between you.
Yes.
And if there is, you can have a conversation, and if there isn't, you change bands or change hobbies, briefly. And I think that's one of the things that has always been so fascinating about shortwave radio, whether it's listening to international broadcast stations, of which there aren't as many as there were when we started, or talking to people on the radio, is that it is so variable, and you never know who's going to be there. You know, one minute you're hearing people from the next town, and the next minute you're hearing people from the next other side of the world.
Yes.
And I think that's kind of the interesting thing about it, and trying to make your equipment work well under both sets of circumstances or for whatever objectives you have. And HF propagation via the ionosphere is something that actually, that's sort of the way it really worked starting early on, that the early pioneers of radio had no idea how this worked. There were a lot of mental models people had, and they'd try things, and if they tried them and they worked, they'd keep doing it. And
then we take it for granted. Yeah.
We take it for granted that something will happen. But we can't take for granted that, for example, you'll be able to maintain a schedule with somebody in South Africa every day on 20 meters at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I mean, some days it works and some days it doesn't. And you can just accept that and say, well, if it doesn't work today, I'll try it again tomorrow. Or you can try to understand what's happening and predict it. And there are a lot of tools available that can help you do that. I mean, basically what happens is the solar energy from the sun strikes our ionosphere and ionizes the various layers of the ionosphere. And the propagation we mostly use on HF is in the outer layers, the F layer, which is the furthest layer from the Earth. In doing so, it passes through the other layers to get there. On the higher frequency bands, 20 meters and up, through typically 10 meters, it passes through the lower layers without any difficulty and gets refracted from the ionosphere. And how or what fraction of the energy gets refracted and what frequencies are supported is very dependent upon how heavily ionized it is, which is dependent upon how much energy comes from the sun.
Right.
Which is different depending on the sunspots and where we are in the sunspot cycle and particular day and how many sunspots are there that day, or more probably that week. It doesn't tend to rapidly change. The other thing that happens is, in addition to the solar energy, there's magnetic energy from the sun that can cause attenuation and noise in the ionosphere.
Yes.
That gets in the way of communication. So both of these things going on, and they're all measurable and recorded, and the numbers are available at different locations on the internet. So we can actually use that data to make predictions. And that's something you can do if you don't want to just take chances on when you're going to be able to talk to somebody. You can actually use that kind of software to predict when you will be able to make contacts and what the probability will be of being able to get through. The one I like and use the most is something called VOACAP, vocap.
Yes, I've heard of that one.
Yeah, and the VOA stands for Voice of America. This was put together at taxpayer expense to help the Voice of America be able to predict what it was doing. And it's online at voacap.com, I think. And it's all available right there. It actually takes in, has its own source for the numbers. You don't have to put in the sunspot numbers or the A or K indices or any of those other things. It's looking at predictions for the current kind of month, in that time frame.
Yes.
So if you want to know what's going to happen next February, you need to have other information to put in there. But if you want to know what's going to happen today or next week, you can use it as it is. You can put in your transmitter station parameters, your antenna type, your power, put in the information about where the other station is that you want to work, a de-expedition or another rear country that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And it will tell you the probability of being able to make contact each hour of the day on each band.
But it's a probability.
It's a probability, like weather forecasting. It's a 70% likelihood of rain. Well, is it going to rain? Well, who knows? If it rains, the guy was right because he said it was a 70% probability. If it doesn't rain, the guy was right because there was a 30% probability that it wouldn't rain. Same sort of thing. But it gives you some information, some insight.
Yes.
The best that can be made without taking your own data between those locations at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives you an idea. Instead of listening all day long hoping to hear this person, you can say, well, at this hour, I'm going to listen on 17 meters, and then mm-hmm. A little later, I'm going to listen on 20 meters and so forth, and that'll give me the best shot of getting there. Now, of course, that doesn't say the person is actually going to be there at those times. That's something that's out of the propagation prediction and control. But if you have a de-expedition, they'll probably be operating on the frequencies that the bands are open to different parts of the world.
Yes.
And so you have a good shot of being there. So it tells you when you can sleep and when you should be up and that sort of thing. So it's all kind of a general rule without the benefit of propagation forecast software is that the best shot is with both ends of the path in common sunlight. So that means it has to be daytime where you are and daytime where the other end is. It doesn't have to be, but that's a good time, good chance that that will work because the sun ionization of the ionosphere will occur across the path.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that could be the direct path or it could be the path around the back, the long path could be in common sunshine, although that's less likely because it's further apart usually.
Now, are we talking about the higher frequencies in this?
The higher frequencies.
Right, because 80 meters isn't going to work.
Exactly right. The problem with 80 meters and 160 meters is that the same ionization that ionizes the F layer also ionizes the D layer, which is between it and the Earth. And the problem with that is the D layer tends to attenuate signals on 80 and 160 meters, sometimes 40 meters as well, which is sort of in between.
Yes.
And they won't get through.
So the same sunlight that makes it possible to make that contact on 15 meters between those two points makes it impossible to have that contact on 160 or 80.
Pretty much. Yeah, that's true. So what happens is that's why 80 and 160 tend to be nighttime bands.
Mm-hmm.
And 20, 15, and 10, and the other bands in that region tend to be daylight bands. Well, that's good. You have something to do either time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the best time is when the D layer hasn't gotten ionized yet and the F layer still is a little bit ionized.
Yes.
And that there's actually a time, a kind of a magic time that's called the gray line. It's just between daylight and night. And at that point, you do have the situation where the D layer, if you're getting towards the from night to daylight, for example, the D layer hasn't yet gotten ionized. Ionized,
mm-hmm.
But there's enough ionization in the F layer to be able to get through. And you can actually get some amazing contacts along that path, along the they're called terminator between day and night, which is in a different place each day because of the tilt of the Earth, changes mm-hmm. by season significant amount. So you can talk to different people, but it makes for a very interesting time. You practically have 15 or 20 minutes to operate in that because it doesn't have to be right. The terminator doesn't have to be right above you, even if it's off some distance, your antenna can radiate into that area from where you mm-hmm. are. As long as you can get to that area, your signals can propagate through that or along it, and you can get good performance then. So you don't have to stay up all night. You can, if you get up early. I have a little problem with that because my dog wants to walk during gray line. And
is this why the 160 and 80 meter enthusiasts get up so awfully early in the morning to workstations? Is it gray line they're chasing?
I wouldn't be surprised. I don't get up that early myself, and now that I'm retired, so to speak, sort of retired. In fact, if I didn't have a dog, I probably wouldn't get up at all. But I'm sure that has something to do with it. And that, you know, a much more productive time than staying up all night.
Mm-hmm.
So if you hit it at just before sunrise and just before sunset, you may have some very nice propagation along the gray line.
Yes, I've seen some very spooky things happen propagation-wise during that time.
Yep.
Remarkable stuff.
So again, it's good to understand how this works so you can focus your time to where it'll do the most good, and that's a very good place to focus.
Mm-hmm. Very good. All right, Joel, we have a question from Marshall, Kilowatt Bravo 4 Delta X-ray, and he's asking, when installing a 2-meter Yagi or UHF beam for vertical polarization, how badly is the pattern front to back and gain affected by the presence of a metal mast and coax feeder. Most guys I know install the beam and don't make any effort to isolate the mast. Usually they route the coax along the boom to the mast and then down. But this places a substantial amount of metal very near the driven element on smaller beams, such as my four-element Yagi, he says. Some manufacturers offer a workaround to this problem by offering end-mounted Yagis, but this places the reflector very near the mast, which I think could also detune that element. What do you think?
Well, that's a very good point to make, and it's one of the problems with vertical polarization is that Yagis naturally have their elements going vertically, and if you put them on a mast, you have the mast in the middle of the Yagi elements. As you point out, it can have a significant impact on the pattern. It's hard to say exactly how much it'll be. I've modeled some and found the pattern of a 7-element Yagi can be converted into that of a 3-element Yagi without any trouble at all by putting the mast in the wrong place. So you put it up and it works, and you talk to people and you think everything's fine.
Right.
But everything could be a lot finer if you had done something different. And it's very dependent on exactly where in the along the Yagi boom the mast is. So one solution is to carefully model the antenna, and you can model the mast as well just by acting as if it were another wire in the antenna model.
Mm-hmm.
And make it really long so it's much longer than the elements. And you'll see what a difference it makes. And you may be able to find a place that you can insert that without causing any great distortion to the pattern or the gain or the front-to-back ratio. Now, to really be good at that, make sure that your antenna model accurately represents the antenna, because if the antenna model is not quite up to snuff, then it won't show up the distortion as well. If it's sort mm-hmm. of pre-distorted, you won't be able to really tell what's due to the Yagi model not being good and what's due to the mast being in the middle of it. But if you have a gain that approaches the manufacturer's spec, chances are you have a pretty good model and you can see what's going to happen. So that's one solution. And if you're lucky, you may find a place that's close enough to the balance point that you can put the mast and have it work. But it's certainly not going to improve things, and the chances are you will have a problem with that. Now, putting the mast behind the Yagi can work well with a small Yagi, as you point out. With a long Yagi, you have some mechanical problems. And some people have countered this by having long false booms going out the back with counterweights on them to put them in balance, but that gets a little cumbersome.
Well, I would imagine.
Yeah, and it has, you know, so your system has to hold up essentially twice as much stuff as it would
mm-hmm.
have to otherwise, which puts strain on the rotator and everything else. But if it's a small Yagi, like your 4-element, and I have one of the same, mounting it behind the reflector is a good idea. But you point out the coax is also important. It acts just like any other metallic element. And you also have to take the coax back along the boom to behind the reflector
mm-hmm.
and down to avoid having it distort the pattern. In my modeling, I've found that the mast does not have to be very far, and a 2-meter beam, 6, 8, 10 inches behind the reflector will have virtually no impact on anything except perhaps a slight change in the front to back. But on my 2-meter operation, having a bad front to back is actually not a terrible idea because you can hear people behind you, and you're more likely to miss somebody behind you than be interfered by somebody behind you. And so it's not like an HF arrangement where you want to eliminate the stations that are interfering from the back. I guess if you had enough density of operators in your area, it might be more of a problem. But it wasn't that big a change anyway. But if you're behind the reflector, keep in mind, with a Yagi array, everything that you want to know about is happening in front of the reflector, so that what happens mm-hmm. behind the reflector is much less significant. So that's a good strategy.
Yes.
The best strategy, though, in my opinion, is to do something different than that, and that is to use a horizontal sort of extra mast and have the antenna itself, end of the horizontal mast, offset from the tower or support structure.
Mm-hmm.
So now the mast is not in the field of the elements. The antenna is far enough away from the tower so that the tower doesn't bother it. And the only problem you have is it's kind of unwieldy. But the easy solution to that is have this horizontal mast going out on the other side as well to balance it and put another antenna there. It could be a second 2-meter antenna to give you extra gain and a sharper pattern. Or it could be one for another band. You could have a 70-centimeter antenna on one side and a 2-meter antenna on the other, both vertically polarized, both with a horizontal mast structure holding them up.
Mm-hmm.
The coax could be fed along that same mast and to the tower and down. And that way you get the benefit of both antennas and a minimization of any interaction to the structural supports for the antenna. So that's a really good way to do it. Gives you a win-win. You get more and better antennas and less pattern distortion.
All right, Joel, before we let you off the hook, one more question. Larry, N8QNM, asks, you often have used the term wide-range antenna tuner. What do you consider to be wide range?
That's a good question, and it's a term I coined because, I don't know if I coined it, or I use frequently, because there's a lot of variation in what antenna tuners can do. And people often talk about using an antenna tuner to tune a non-resonant antenna, such as a center-fed ZEP, or some, which is a dipole fed with window line. Be used for multiple bands, and that will work fine with some tuners, and it will not work with others. And the issue is their tuning range. There's a category of tuners which I call a trimming tuner. Again, I think that I may have made that term up, so you won't necessarily find that anyplace else. But a lot of transceivers have antenna tuners built into them that have a specified tuning range of up to 3-to-1 SWR. Sometimes they'll say it'll match loads from 16 to 150 ohms, and what they really mean is a 3-to-1 SWR.
Yeah.
Now, that's fine, and it's very handy for something. For example, if you have a 20-meter Yagi that's tuned, a sharply tuned antenna that's tuned for 14.0 for CW operation, it may have a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio at the high end of the phone band.
Mm-hmm.
And with a few turns or a few pushes of your button, you can bring that in to use on 20-meter sideband with your transceiver. Nothing wrong with that, but that's nowhere near the range of tuning that you need to do with a typical center-fed ZEP.
Right.
And I find that the tuners that are spec'd at, say, a 10-to-1 SWR are kind of the ones you want to use for that application. And sometimes the SWR is going to be actually higher than that. But that's what I call a wide-range antenna tuner. And it may not be wide enough, actually, in some cases, but it's a lot wider than 3-to-1. And it can tune many of these wide or multi-band window line fed or open wire fed antennas that need to be transformed to 50 ohms from it can be a very high or very low impedance.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have that kind of a tuning capability, you're not going to be successful with one of those antennas. So
Right. It's
not enough to just say, I have an antenna tuner. You have to have an antenna tuner that will match the impedances that your antenna system delivers to it. That's why I make the distinction between a trimming antenna tuner and a wide-range tuner, so people don't think that having an antenna tuner is sufficient. It has to be a sufficiently wide-tuning antenna tuner. It's worth mentioning that in many cases, tuners will tune wider than their specified range, particularly in the middle bands.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what the typical arrangement is, on the lower frequency bands, tuners just run out of inductance range.
Yes.
And that takes more space and a lot more money to make a bigger tuner. On the higher bands, the limitation is often the capacitance of wires within the tuner and variable capacitors to the frame and so forth, or the chassis of the tuner, and that limits it on the high end. But in the middle, let's say 40 meters or 20 meters or 30 meters in the middle range of the bands,
mm-hmm.
you probably have neither of those limitations. So you may find you can go to much higher SWRs and be successful at tuning them. But be careful, because the tuner is designed for a 10-to-1 SWR. That means it's designed to handle voltages that are as high as the square root of 10 or 3 point something times the voltage that would be in a matched situation, or the same number, up to the same number times the current that would be there in a matched situation.
Mm-hmm.
Put in more current and destroy inductors, put in more voltage, and you'll arc over capacitors. And I've done that. And so even though it can tune, if it tunes at a higher SWR, you're not necessarily doing well.
No.
You need to reduce your power so that the voltage or the current, and you won't have both. You'll have one or the other, or maybe neither. I mean, it can be that the high voltage point and the high current point are someplace out in the transmission line.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not likely to melt that. But unless you carefully calculate exactly what's going on in the tuner, you can destroy the tuner. And
absolutely,
I've done
yes.
I have. Ah, you did that too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, my situation, I was using a jury-rigged 160-meter antenna, which had an impedance of about 4 ohms.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to get it to tune with my 1,500-watt rated antenna tuner, rated for 10-to-1 SWR. Actually, it must have been less than 5 ohms, because 5 ohms would have been a 10-to-1 SWR. It was probably 1 ohm. And I put a whole bunch of extra capacitors on the output side, and I was able to get it to tune, and it worked fine at 100 watts. Mm-hmm. And I turned on the linear and put 500 watts into it, and all of a sudden it didn't work anymore. And I found out what I had done. I had actually vaporized a gold-plated switch contact. Now, that takes some effort.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a third of the power that the tuner was rated at. So you can easily do that. So just use a little care. It's not always good news that you can go beyond the ratings of something.
Absolutely not. Well, thank you, Joel. I appreciate it, as always.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.